Welcome, pals, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that celebrates the best of the worst, except this week we are celebrating the best of the best. I am Ben Vanderveld, and alongside me is the very best podcast co-host a boy could wish for, Barry McStay.
You're such a good boy, you got a Barry this Christmas.
Yeah.
And he's for life as well.
A Barry is for life, not just for Christmas. There's a slogan that will baffle anyone not from the United Kingdom and Ireland.
Oh yeah, of course. That's not really a thing. Well, maybe, I don't know, is that a thing people know overseas? A dog is not just for Christmas, it's for life, is the saying. Was that an RSPCA?
It was either RSPCA or Dogs Trust. It was one of the two.
Yeah. It's sort of a motto to make people look after your dogs, because, you know, if they come on this podcast, they tend to get tortured.
They do. Obviously, what they don't know is that the next slogan down was cats, fuck them.
Yeah. By the way, I realize if dogs come on this podcast, they tend to get tortured is a confusing statement if you are a new listener to this podcast and you haven't listened to the back catalogue.
Yes.
What I mean to say is, in our research of a lot of the worst things humans have ever done, a lot of experiments tend to involve dogs, it turns out.
Yeah, it's not like we're about to go, hello, welcome to Crazy Ben and Uncle Barry's Canine Torture Emporium. In you come, Snuffles.
To be fair, there's a podcast for everything these days. The dog torture podcast is probably massive on Spotify somewhere if you go looking for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very true crime podcast.
Yeah. But we're not talking about dog torture this week.
No, not until we get to the world's best fetish episode. Sorry, I'm not happy with that. We are doing one of our semi-regular happy episodes, despite the past 90 seconds of our lives. The reason being mostly plague-related. We had a negative COVID emergency at my house this week, as well as a positive throat and gastroenteritis-based pincer movement from my children on my immune system, which meant that recording a regular episode was not a possibility. So instead, we thought we would throw some sunshine into your lives by going back over some previous episodes and giving mine and Barry's best selections for them rather than our worst nominations. Before we rush headlong into the warm bubble bath of this week's episode, we should say hello to yet another Patreon supporter. Hello to Eilish Phillips, who joins us from Northern Ireland. She is a £5 a month donor, which means that she, as well as enjoying our extra content and getting a badge sent to her and being mentioned right now, she gets to nominate a future podcast topic. She gave us a tasting menu to choose from: Lighthouse, Car Chase, Kiss, Origin Story, or Last Words. And I think we're going to go for Lighthouse Barry has written a play about lighthouses.
It remains unproduced.
Yeah. Well,
but it is very good.
Thank you, Mystery Voice. So thank you, Eilish, so much for your support. As ever, if you want to support us, and that'd be very welcome at this time, you can go to patreon.com/worstfootforward. There are all sorts of goodies and the ability to nominate a show. Potentially more exciting goodies very close by on the horizon, asterisk, news pending.
Mm.
That's the thing. Right, to business.
Yeah, so we're looking at episodes 81 to 85 this week. Mm-hmm. In episode 81, we looked at the world's worst prank with Francesco Di Carlo. In episode 82, we talked about the world's worst resignation with Oscar Toman. We're skipping episode 83 because it was a special episode where we played a game of Monopoly, the world's worst board game definitively, with friend of the show Paul Flannery. And God knows there's nothing good about Monopoly, so we're not... We're not going to grace it.
Maybe we should maybe talk about the world's best Monopoly, which I'm going to say is a small town in Puglia in southern Italy called Monopoly, with an I at the end, that me and my wife visited before my children were born. In fact, during the manufacture process, during the manufacture week rather than the particular process, and had a delightful time there.
What an interesting foreplay that must be. Like, just a bit of smooching on the sofa. Now, to Monopoly, and continue. Yes.
Well, yeah, no, well, you know, because of the term that I've used, part of our foreplay involved me in a yellow hard hat. We did the foreplay, and I was the foreman.
I thought you were going to say you were the little dog, and she was the thimble. Episode 84, we talked about the world's worst emperor with Tom Bell. And in episode 85, we talked about the world's worst detective with Taylor Glenn. And so we're going to try and find the bests in those categories, which means we're going to start with the world's best prank. Now, our worst prank was that played by the political wartime executive, our friends at the Special Operations branch in the UK during World War II, where they set up the fake radio station Gustav Siegfried Eins, which is a hoax radio station broadcast in Germany. And the final episode was meant to be this German dissatisfied DJ who would badmouth the Nazi government being raided and being killed live on air. And they managed to air the same episode twice in a night, so it kind of killed the liveness of it. So that was our worst prank. What have you found for good pranks, Ben?
So your amuse-bouche for this comes from Alabama in 1998. According to a report in the New Mexicans for Science and Reason newsletter, the Alabama state legislature did something absolutely maverick in the world of maths and science. As you'll know, they are bastions of orthodoxy and stricture, and they decided that the number pi was a little bit too untidy, and so it declared that the Alabama state legislature would be declaring the number pi a nice round 3.0 from now on. And their reason being is they declared that 3.0 was a more biblical value than 3.1415, etc.
Is the Alabama State Legislature is that in a Capitol building with a dome on top of it, where as soon as they reshaped pi, the dome just fell in because the numbers didn't work anymore?
That would have been perfect, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. I'm sure we've said it before, but we'll mention it again. The prank from the BBC in the 1950s of the spaghetti growing harvest, which is a story that my dad loved telling me, of a very austere BBC presenter saying to camera about here in this region of Italy, there are trees where spaghetti is grown on them, and showing old Italian mamas taking the fresh spaghetti down from the trees.
I think it was Richard Dimbleby was the
presenter.
Yes, it was. I think it was a Panorama broadcast. Richard Dimbleby, the Dimbleby's are titans of British broadcasting. Panorama, I think, was the programme, which is, again, a very well-respected programme on British TV. So, yeah, they claimed there was a spaghetti harvest. I think it was in Northern Italy and Switzerland or something they claimed it was in.
Oh, gosh, it was, wasn't it?
It's great. The stills from it are really funny. It's been some runner's job to hang bits of spaghetti or string over a tree. Probably in the garden behind Broadcasting House.
And one other thing before my nomination, I found a musical hoax, something called The Masked Marauders. And The Masked Marauders is an album that was released in 1969 and was part of a hoax concocted by Rolling Stone magazine. And they rang a review of this non-existent album purporting to capture the most super of super groups. There was obviously a huge penchant for super groups in the 1960s, groups like Cream and the Yardbirds. I guess in a way Led Zeppelin were a super group, really. But this one claimed to include Dylan, Mick Jagger, George Harrison, John Lennon and Paul McCartney. If anything, too super. The review claimed that none of the artists could be listed on the jacket cover because of contractual agreements with their other record companies. Yeah, that's a big giveaway. And yeah. The joke was extended by hiring an obscure band to record an actual album and getting a deal with Warner Brothers. The album even reached 114 on Billboard's album charts. Yeah, but there's all sorts of nonsense on it. What I loved here is in the liner notes, my favourite clue is, in a world of sham, the Masked Marauders, bless their hearts, are the genuine article. So some of the song titles are a giveaway as well. The opening track, I Can't Get No Nookie, instead of I Can't Get No Satisfaction, which has an actual Mick Jagger impersonator on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have Cow Pie, which has spoken vocals from a Bob Dylan impersonator. I Am the Japanese Sandman. The Book of Love, which actually incorporates bits of Norwegian wood on it. It was put in place by a chap called Grail Marcus. It was one of the most famous journalists of the 1960s. And he said to MSNBC years later, it was just an attempt to say, this is stupid. Let's make it even stupider. what I love about the article that I read about it was said, like, actually, it was prophetic because 20 years later, Bob Dylan and George Harrison got together with Tom Petty and Roy Orbison to create a band called the Traveling Wilburys, which some rock and roll fans and Beatles fans adore. I think the Traveling Wilburys are terrible. But I was delighted to discover that. But for my nomination for the world's best prank, we're going to one of the most famous sons of your country, Jonathan Swift.
He had a sense of humour.
Yeah, he did. He played a prank on a chap called John Partridge, who was an English astrologer. He began life as a shoemaker, but taught himself Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and astrology and enrolled at Leiden University. And he styled himself as Physician to His Majesty. Now, he was a physician at court. He never attended on the king or received any salary. And he...
Sorry, I'm now hearing volunteer physician.
There you go.
I'm not thinking St. John's Ambulance.
Yeah. He was at court in his nice little yellow jacket.
Yeah.
he was most infamous for selling bogus predictions to the public in almanacs. And in 1708, he predicted that a fever would sweep London in early April. And so Swift published an almanac under a fake name, predicting that on March the 29th at 11 p.m, Partridge would die of a raging fever. The public was intrigued, but Partridge was quite angry, so he published a really swift rebuttal to Swift, calling Jonathan Swift a fraud. And on the night of March 29th, Jonathan Swift upped the ante by publishing an elegy under a fake name, announcing that Partridge, a cobbler, starmonger, and quack, had died and admitted on his deathbed that he was a fraud. The fake name that he published it under was Isaac Bickerstaff, which is a great fake name. News of John Partridge's death spread over the next couple of days, so that when John Partridge walked down the street on April the 1st, people stared at him in surprise and incomprehension.
On April the 1st?
On April the 1st, yeah. John Partridge was so angry about this that he published a pamphlet to insist that he was alive, at which point Jonathan Swift again publicly asserted that Partridge was dead and claimed that Partridge's pamphlet was written by someone else. And it was so successful that Partridge had to stop publishing almanacs because he was so discredited
for being alive.
Yes,
it just goes to show that people are like, well, in a he said like that, we're going to believe Jonathan Swift over John Partridge's word that John Partridge is dead.
Yep. And my favorite bit of it is that the hoax plagued Partridge to the end of his actual life. So there were mourners who believed him to be dead, often kept him awake at night by crying outside his window. There are accounts of an undertaker arriving at his house to arrange drapes for the mourning, and even a gravestone being carved.
Wow. And then when he actually died, probably no one showed up to the funeral because they all thought, well, didn't that guy die 20 years ago?
Right, precisely.
Right, well, that sort of puts me in mind of it. Yeah, I have a couple of sort of ones I wanted to mention before my favourite one as well. I think we've mentioned the Berners Street hoax in the past.
Yeah.
We've written about that in one of the chapters of the book we're working on. The Berners Street hoax was concocted by a chap called Theodore Hook, who was a composer, intellectual, and described by Samuel Taylor Coleridge as true a genius as Dante. And Hook really liked a joke or two. He also apparently the person who sent the first ever postcard in history in 1840. But yeah, he made a bet with an architect and playwright called Samuel Beazley that he could turn any house in London into the most talked about address in the city. And so in November 1809, a chimney sweep showed up at 54 Berners Street, the home of a Mrs. Tottenham. And the maid who answered the door, you know, it's early in the morning, dismissed the chimney sweep, only to discover another chimney sweep arriving shortly afterwards, and another. 12 chimney sweeps in total arrived, and then were succeeded by cartloads of coal, several wedding cakes, fishmongers, shoemakers, more than a dozen pianos and an organ being delivered, as well as lawyers, doctors, and priests who'd been told there was someone dying in the house. Not to mention distinguished guests who all had invitations asking them to call on the house, including the Governor of the Bank of England, the Lord Mayor of London, the Duke of York, and the Archbishop of Canterbury.
It's just incredible. It just makes Dom Jolly and Phone Jacker look like lazy tryhards, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a proper good. And obviously, you've got the onlookers and passers-by who show up wondering what the hell is going on. So, yes, fair to say, Hook did win that bet and watched the chaos from a house over the road, apparently.
Like, I really like to hope that he was just giggling away to himself.
Apparently he left London for a short holiday soon afterwards just to make sure that he didn't catch any heat. Another one from London, there was obviously a menagerie of animals kept in the Tower of London. The king or queen of the day kept a menagerie of animals there, polar bears and lions, even a zebra, which was said to drink beer, was kept in the Tower of London. And on April Fool's Day 1698, a trickster, unnamed trickster, managed to convince a bunch of people that the lions in the Tower of London were about to receive their annual bath. Now, no such thing ever happened, certainly not in public.
Well, obviously not. Cats don't like having a bath.
Well, exactly, yeah. God, woe betide the zookeeper who tries to say to the lion, now is time for your shower.
I'd love the thought of just a zookeeper really close to a lion going, puss, 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 puss.
Yeah, with a loofah in one hand and a bar of soap in the other. But the word spread and a whole bunch of passers-by showed up asking to visit the tower to have a look at the lions being bathed, and obviously wasn't happening. But for the next couple of centuries, apparently, this con became a running joke. Even after the last lion had left the tower, apparently. There were people in the 19th century...
Sorry, just because of how famous it is that if the ravens leave, then the tower will fall down. I like the idea of the last lion leaving the tower and the ravens just going, and stay out.
Yeah. Well, early in the 19th century, the lions were moved, and indeed the rest of the menagerie were all moved to the new zoo in London in Regent's Park. But it didn't stop people late into the latter half of the 19th century showing up. Not least in 1856, people were issued with invitations signed by Herbert de Grasson, apparently a senior warden at the Tower of London, with a blob of wax on it and as a seal, and a warning on it saying it is requested that no gratuities will be given to the wardens on any account. And it asks the bearer to witness the annual ceremony of the washing of the lions at the Tower of London. And obviously the thing was dated 1st of April. but lots of people apparently missed the date and still showed up, despite the fact this was a running joke for a couple of centuries at that point. But my favourite prank is another one we've, I think, touched on in the past. And again, I've written about in a chapter for the book. This is from 1944 and Sweden. And it's our friends at the Special Operations Executive. Two agents in Sweden, Ewan Butler and Janet Gow, learned that there was going to be a performance of a new comic play starring the German actor Georg Alexander at the German embassy in Stockholm. And tickets were by invitation only. And despite not knowing what the invitations looked like, Butler and Gow created 3,000 fake invitations for this gala performance, stamping them with serial numbers just to make them look even more authentic, and distributed them to 3,000 prominent Swedish Nazi sympathisers. The invitations requested formal evening wear, assuring them there was no RSVP necessary. And so on the day of the gala, thousands of infuriated Swedish Nazis, men in top hats and women in fur coats, show up at the German embassy in Stockholm, trying to barge past ushers who are going, no, 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 you're at the wrong place, this isn't right. And the performance apparently was delayed for several hours, and the Swedish newspapers, who were obviously no fan of their German guests, ridiculed their occupiers. Butler described the outcome of this hoax as gratifyingly chaotic.
I love the fact that he has reviewed his hoax with the most perfect choice of words.
Yeah, so that's my suggestion. So, I mean, the Special Operations Executive have a special place in our heart, but I do love the Jonathan Swift, John Partridge beef over the fact that he's one of them is claiming the other is dead.
It's the fact that Jonathan Swift doubled down And yeah, that makes it, and then sort of tripled down and won. It's so good.
Yeah. So let's go with Swift v. Partridge.
Great.
The original beef. In episode 82, we talked to Oscar Toman about the world's worst resignation. And I think my suggestion won this, which was the resignation of Lord Jellicoe. Lord Jellicoe was a politician, and in May 1973, he admitted, largely unprompted, some casual affairs with call girls from an agency called Mayfair Escorts. And now, this was prompted by the fact that at the time, another member of the House of Lords, Lord Lambton, was involved in a prostitution scandal, and notebooks were found mentioning a place called Jellicoe House. But just because of the word Jellicoe being in them, Lord Jellicoe assumed he was going to be linked to some sort of call girl scandal as well and decided to get ahead of the story.
I'm so excited by the thought of how panicked he will have been.
Yeah. So I've picked a couple out for this one. I really liked, this is in 2009, W. Neil Barrett was employed at Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard in San Francisco, California, and he resigned amicably in 2009, as I said, with a formal resignation letter and also a big resignation cake. So he wheeled in a cake which read, "Dear Mr. Bowers, during the past 3 years, my tenure at Hunter's Point Naval Shipyard has been nothing short of pure excitement, joy, and whim. However, I've decided to spend more time with my family and attend to health issues that have recently arisen. I'm proud to have been part of such an outstanding team, and I wish this organisation only the finest in future endeavours. Please accept this cake as notification that I'm leaving my position." It's my favourite thing is it's such a formal letter.
Yes.
Apart from the word cake. I also really liked when Conan O'Brien left The Tonight Show in 2010. So Conan took over The Tonight Show after Jay Leno. He'd been promised that he was going to take the job by NBC. And he was finding his feet with the show. And, you know, Jay had been there for ages. You'd expect to be given a long time to bed in. He left the show after just 7 months when NBC tried to move his show back half an hour to accommodate a new Jay Leno program, basically meaning that The Tonight Show would actually be in the early hours of tomorrow. Conan obviously found this unacceptable, and there was a whole big acrimonious fallout where Conan left the network and Jay ended up taking back over The Tonight Show. And Conan issued a resignation statement from the show, which began, "People of Earth." "In the last few days, I've been getting a lot of sympathy calls, and I want to start by making it clear that no one should waste a second feeling sorry for me. For 17 years, I've been getting paid to do what I love most, and in a world with real problems, I've been absurdly lucky. That said, I've been suddenly put in a very public predicament, and my bosses are demanding an immediate decision." He goes on in the letter to say, "My staff and I have worked unbelievably hard, and we are very proud of our contribution to the legacy of The Tonight Show, but I cannot participate in what I honestly believe is its destruction." And he finishes the letter by saying, "Have a great day, and for the record, I'm truly sorry about my hair. It's always been that way." A comedian to the end, Conan.
Yeah, very classy.
But my favourite resignation... This could go either way. This could be a world's worst resignation, or it could be a best resignation. But it's just the story. I remember this from 2010. A JetBlue flight attendant, Stephen Slater, who decided to resign while the plane was, I think, still on the runway. A passenger refused to stay seated in advance of the flight taking off from JFK Airport. And this air steward, Stephen Slater, swore at the defiant passenger, grabbed a beer, and popped the lever for the plane's inflatable emergency chute, on the way sliding out of the plane, announcing, "That's it, I'm done."
It's to resign with that level of sass.
It's so good.
Just remarkable.
Yeah. Another air steward on the day, David Gardner, told the Daily Mail Slater was having a really bad day. And we've all been there, we've worked in the service industry. There are just days when you are not here for the crap that customers want to give you. But being able to resign while taking a beer and sliding out of your place of work,
that's
the amazing
thing. It's because the temptation is there. Like, I can't resign from my job, but I could resign from a gig. But I know that if I do that, there's going to be an ignominious walk from the stage to the dressing room to pick up my stuff. And then I have to walk probably through the audience to my car and then fume and cry all the way home whilst listening to Andrew WK's Party Hard at Full Volume.
Yeah.
Whereas if I was just like, if at any point this is too much for me, I can quit and fuck off down an inflatable slide. That is such a tempting big red button to push.
Yeah, yeah. You'd like to hope that water parks, the big boss's office is at the top of one of the log flumes. You can then slide your way out of there.
But I also feel like the boss's office should be above one of those targets where if you hit it enough, then a trapdoor opens and then they just go down into one of the broken slides.
I should say that Stephen Slater was arrested after his resignation for criminal mischief and reckless endangerment and was sentenced to a year's probation. But I don't know. I'd say it's worth it.
Makes it cooler being arrested, especially for criminal mischief.
Yeah.
That is the second greatest crime I've ever heard of. When I very first started doing stand-up, I had a bit. It was basically me reporting a thing I'd heard and hoping that the audience would take it as a joke. About, I think, the musician Rick James, who wrote Super Freak, which is the song upon which Can't Touch This nicks the bass line. And he was arrested for aggravated mayhem. I don't know what you have to do to make your mayhem aggravated, but yeah. I'm a large fan of that.
That's so good.
I'm not going to lie, Stephen Slater was my choice as well, so he goes through. But just a quick little bit of garnish to that. I quite enjoy the Sun Microsystems CEO, Jonathan Schwartz. He became the first Fortune 200 executive to quit his job with a tweet.
Yeah, okay. Moment in history.
But he didn't bother with 140 characters. Because he quit via a haiku. Financial crisis. Stalled too many customers. CEO no more. I'll be honest. I'm sure he had an incredibly well-paid care package to look after him as he went. But I admire the style.
Yeah.
But the most stylish I found was a woman called Marina Shifrin. She worked online for a sort of BuzzFeed-type media machine. And she decided to quit, particularly because the bosses she worked for were making higher and higher demands for videos that would just get the clicks. And all they cared about was clicks over the quality of video. So she made a quitting video of her own. It begins with her arriving at work at 4:30 a.m. Then Kanye West's Gone kicks in and she shows off some genuinely impressive dance moves all around the empty office, which she is flicking the V's to. And then at the end, she pops and locks in a business-like blazer, captions all of her grievances on the screen, and then ends with a final, I quit. And that got so many views on YouTube. It got 50 million views on YouTube, at which point she was very famous to the extent that she got a guest spot on the Queen Latifah show. And on that appearance, Queen Latifah offered her a job.
Amazing.
Right.
I mean, I hope she said yes.
I presume she did, yes.
That is a bit tricky, though. It's a bit like, you know, proposing to someone in public. Imagine if Queen Latifah gets turned down.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Imagine if Queen Latifah proposed to you in public.
Your Majesty.
Yeah.
How could I refuse?
It would be a honour to remain your humble servant.
The only queen I will take the knee to.
That is not true. I've seen the way you respond to "I want to break free."
To be fair. But we're going with Stephen Slater, aren't we?
Yeah, we've got him. We've got to.
We've got him. It's legendary.
Yeah, we doff our caps to him.
In episode 84, we talked to Tom Bell, aka Lord Fear, about the world's worst emperor. And our choice was our old friend, Emperor Norton of the United States. If you don't know about Emperor Norton, go back and listen to this episode. He is one of our absolute faves we've ever talked about. Essentially, a homeless guy on the streets of San Francisco who styled himself as the first emperor of the USA, who became a bit of a local hero, whose funeral was attended by about 30,000 people. Mm-hmm. Well, we love him to bits. Have you got anyone to rival Emperor Norton, though? Because he's very much one of our worst, who is also the best.
Yeah, absolutely. So to the extent that we also did a special Third Foot episode where we drilled down even further into his story to explore how much that we love him. Because, as you say, he's the worst emperor, but he's also, we chose him that because we believe he's a heroic failure. We did that extra episode. And to very much emphasize that point, I'm also choosing him as the best emperor. because there is no other choice. The only other possible candidate was when we did this episode and talked about the world's best monarchs, I talked about Pedro II of Brazil, who is nicknamed Pedro the Magnanimous. And he was a very warm, kind, and benevolent monarch, and did lots of wonderful things for the population of Brazil. If you want to hear them in detail, listen to the corresponding episode of Best of the Worst for him. But obviously, all of what he did was very much undid later on by the military and other terrible Brazilian monarchs. So all I've done for this is just look at things with Emperor Norton that I feel like we've missed, and also end up in a very intriguing conclusion. So just some notes of things that we may not have talked about with him before. He issued numerous decrees on matters of state. This is what I love about him. He wasn't just a homeless, mischievous, possibly mentally ill, but possibly not, possibly neurodivergent, but possibly not guy. He also committed to the bit. He released proclamations. He had his own money printed.
So my brain just suddenly got ahead of you and thought you were going to say he released albums.
Yeah, he released albums. He was one of the secret recorders on the Mixed Marauders album.
Emperor Norton, foot Thomas Edison.
on the original recording of She's Electric.
Yeah. He collabed with AC, but not DC.
Yeah. Yeah, like Nikola Tesla released such a diss track of it afterwards. he released a decree criticizing the United States Congress, saying it should be abolished because it was full of fraud and corruption and didn't express the public voice. Wonderfully, he ordered all interested parties in the same decree to assemble at a music hall in San Francisco to remedy the evil complained of. Now, I know he probably means a concert hall there, but I just like the notion that he's sort of sticking it to the Congress even further because he's saying, we should assemble at this home of variety instead.
Yeah.
In 1862, he ordered both the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestant Church to publicly ordain him emperor. So he's trying to outdo Charlemagne there. And he hoped that that would also help resolve the disputes that resulted in the American Civil War. In 1869, he declared that the Democratic and Republican parties should be abolished. And in 1862, when Mexico was invaded by Napoleon III, the French emperor, because it was not able to pay its war reparations, it was suggested by one person that Emperor Norton take the title Protector of Mexico, because no one had been appointed that, and there was a popular legend that Norton was actually the son of Napoleon III. He obliged and added the title to his many proclamations, but he later revoked it, saying, "It's impossible to protect such an unsettled nation." So a little bit of black on his ledger there, not looking after the Mexicans.
Yeah.
He shares something in common with William McGonagall.
Oh, did he write to Queen Victoria?
Yes, and never got a response.
Oh.
He also sent many letters to Kamehameha V, the King of Hawaii, regarding the nature of Hawaii. Obviously, it wasn't a part of America at the time. And indeed, by the end of his reign, Kamehameha wouldn't recognize the Democratic American government. He only recognized Norton as the sole leader of the United States.
Wow.
This might be me projecting on him and making him appear more progressive than he actually was, but when he began drafting his proclamations, at first he would send them to local newspapers, most famously the Daily Alta California. After a while, the newspaper editors took advantage of this and would draft their own pretend proclamations, and Norton didn't like this. He felt he was being taken advantage of. So in 1871, he went to the black-owned and operated Pacific Appeal, which he decreed would from now on be his own imperial organ. And for the next 5 years, they published over 250 proclamations, including one, I believe, if I'm timing it right, which Norton decried the anti-Chinese sentiment in San Francisco.
Yeah, I remember that being a feature when we talked about him, yeah.
Yeah.
Seemed like a decent guy.
He really did. So two last little things on him. He was associated throughout his reign with Bummer and Lazarus. Do you know who Bummer and Lazarus were?
Horses?
You're right that they're animals. They were two noted stray dogs who were essentially San Franciscan celebrities. And he ate free at lunch counters when he shared meals with them, even though he didn't own them. Now, these dogs were recognized for their unique bond and prodigious rat-killing ability, and they would turn up in newspapers all the time. So the story goes, in 1861, Bummer rescued another dog from a fight with a larger dog, and this dog was badly injured with a deep gash on its leg, and it was not expected to live. But Bummer coaxed him to eat and brought back scraps from scavenging missions and huddled next to him to keep him warm at night. The injured dog recovered quickly and became known as Lazarus. And it turned out that he was an even better ratter than Bummer. But they apparently were exceptional. They could finish off 85 rats in 20 minutes was their top record.
That's some good ratting.
It really is. They were portrayed in cartoons a lot, and they were personified in some. So Bummer was portrayed as a gentleman down on his luck, but still faithful and conscientious, whereas Lazarus, who was more of a mongrel, was seen as sort of sly and self-serving and a fair-weather friend. But I mean, it does say a lot about the amount of news going around in San Francisco at the time. But this is the extent of their fame. When Lazarus was taken in 1862 by a new dog catcher, apparently a mob of angry citizens demanded his release and petitioned to have the pair of them declared city property. He was released. Him and Bummer were declared exempt from city ordinance against strays. And apparently, a week later, the two were reported to have stopped a runaway horse.
Wow. So, they're heroes.
Yeah. The last person of all I'm going to tell you about, and you're going to like this person a lot, is José Julio Sarria. Now, Sarria was born in 1922 in California. And died in 2013 in New Mexico. And Sarria was a Latino American drag performer and political activist, and was the first openly gay person to run for public office in the United States.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, he was the only child of a Colombian mother. He'd served in World War II as a staff sergeant. After the war, he took a job waiting tables at the Black Cat Cafe in San Francisco. He began singing while waiting tables, and then that took form as a drag performer. He did one-man versions of operas, which he would mold with having local references and humorous commentary. And the Black Cat became a bohemian venue into a world-famous gay bar. At this time, there was a huge amount of police harassment of the LGBTQ community. And Sarria encouraged his fellow performers to stand up for themselves and reject this. His slogan was, "United we stand, divided they arrest us, one by one." He founded all sorts of activist organizations like the League for Civil Education, the Society for Individual Rights, the Tavern Guild of San Francisco, and his activism, whilst he didn't win, he paved the way for the likes of Harvey Milk. And one of his nicknames was the Absolute Empress the First. Another was the Nightingale of Montgomery Street. But a third was Widow Norton, which was a reference to Emperor Norton.
Oh, his empress. The empress to his emperor.
The empress to his emperor. So I absolutely adore that our pal Emperor Norton has a direct line to the struggle for LGBTQ rights in America in the 20th century, making him even cooler.
Yeah. And the more I read about this guy, he's the best. Well, yeah, he's obviously going to win.
Yeah.
But I have some emperor facts for you. Do you know who the longest serving emperor in history was?
I mean, it's because being emperor is so hard to define, because Louis the 16th was the longest serving king, wasn't he?
Louis the 14th.
Louis the 14th, yes. Excuse me. And he sometimes got to refer to himself as being imperial.
The longest serving person who was the emperor, who was head of an empire, is Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria and then Austria-Hungary. Mm-hmm. For 67 years, 355 days, just short of the 68 years. Obviously, Queen Victoria was Empress of India, not for all of her 63 years on the throne. So the longest serving Emperor of the British Empire, do you know who that is?
George the Third?
George the Fifth. George the Fifth was the Emperor for 26 years. The Empire didn't exist prior to Victoria.
The title was created
for her, basically.
Yeah, so it was a gift. What do you get for the monarch who has everything? India.
Yeah. And largest empires, of the top five empires in terms of the, you know, percentage of the world they covered.
Well, the largest land empire was the Mongol Empire.
Yeah, that's the largest contiguous empire in history, was the Mongol. Yeah, they covered 17.81% of the Earth's surface entirely traversable by land. The British Empire was bigger, 26.35% of the world owned by the British, but obviously not contiguous. And the three after the Mongols are second, and the three after that are the Russian Empire, the Qing Dynasty, and the Spanish Empire, complete, rounding out the top five. And the Mongol Empire is amazing, and Genghis Khan, obviously the founder of that, bringing together lots of nomadic tribes, disparate sort of subsects of the same culture, and then sweeping across Europe and Asia and lots of China in, you know, a phenomenal amount of time to cover that much of the Earth's surface. But I read about the five good emperors for my for my best emperor.
Mm-hmm.
The five good emperors is a period of Roman history, from the succession of Nerva in 96. Through Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Aurelius, who is my best emperor. And this period is considered the, you know, the glory days of the Roman Empire. And they're not successors by bloodline. Nerva was sort of elected emperor by the people who assassinated Domitian, who preceded him. And the others were all sort of adopted heirs. They're sort of distantly related, but they weren't, you know, son of son of son. The empire expanded a lot during this period, from northern Britain to Dacia, Arabia, Mesopotamia. They set up a solid provincial system. Edward Gibbon, who wrote The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, said if a man were called upon to fix that period in history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the deaths of Domitian to the succession of Commodus, who succeeded Marcus Aurelius. Now, obviously, Edward Gibbon, writing in the 1700s, had a very rosy view of what anyone of humankind would consider the best period of human history. A period which saw a lot of bloodshed, slavery, imposed conquest, all these sort of things, you know, rights for women weren't exactly high on the list for these five good emperors. But nevertheless, Marcus Aurelius on this list is a pretty, you know, likable figure. He spent a lot of his period fighting on the borders of Rome. He didn't spend a lot of time in Rome itself. He was usually at war with the Parthians and the Germans. But the thing he's sort of best known for are his meditations. He was considered a philosopher emperor. He's still studied today by students of philosophy. His meditations were basically a journal he kept while he was on campaign. And he was a paragon of Stoic philosophy, and they'd be praised down through the centuries. You know, 2,000 years later, people are still studying the things he wrote and said. And he was he was a warrior, but he experienced a lot of personal loss. His wife died while he was on campaign, his brothers who died. One of them was his co-emperor who perished. And so he was prone to a lot of introspection, Marcus Aurelius. He had things that he liked to say included, the best revenge is to be unlike him who performed the injury, which I really like as an adage. When you arise in the morning, think of what a precious privilege it is to be alive, to breathe, to think, to enjoy, to love. And this one, which feels like a warning for the social media age, the object of life is not to be on the side of the majority, but to escape finding oneself in the ranks of the insane.
Oh, I like that a lot. Obviously, the thing that sort of colours this for me is that he was writing this while sat in an encampment preparing to go to war. So he's just kind of like...
With the Germans.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to gently stroke my beard and write some incredibly deep and meaningful philosophy and then get up in the morning and go, right, go kill those guys because they're not real people.
Yeah, it's yet again, humans are complicated figures because, you know, terrible bloodthirsty people, the Romans, but also this guy wrote a lot of very nice Instagram sayings.
He did. Sorry, you said that like such a curtain twitching woman from the 1950s. Like terrible bloodthirsty people, the Romans.
But what did they ever do for us? They gave us this meme.
Well, precisely. I would like to put a filter over this section so it's voiced by Terry Jones in a wig.
Yeah, so lots of caveats, obviously, but as emperors go, I quite like Marcus Aurelius. But my fave and your fave and our BFF forever is Emperor Norton, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I know this isn't possible, but to be so on point for this podcast, if we can somehow discover that Emperor Norton was either born or died on February the 30th, then this podcast will have peaked.
Finally, we talked about the world's worst detective with Taylor Glenn of Drunk Women Solving Crime fame. And we picked Herlock Sholmes, the creation of Maurice LeBlanc, who wrote the Arsène Lupin stories. Basically, he was ripping off and mocking Sherlock Holmes and saying that his own creation, Lupin, was a far superior detective. Who did I pick for this? I read a little bit about... I quite like... This is a contemporary detective, Kiran Bedi. She's an Indian social activist, former tennis player and politician. She was the first woman in India to join the officer ranks of the Indian Police Service in 1972. She later went on to be Lieutenant Governor of Pondicherry. And I just like, she was a national junior tennis champion, then went on to rise through the ranks as assistant superintendent of police, then moved to West Delhi. She brought about a marked reduction in crimes against women. She was Deputy Commissioner of Police in North Delhi. She launched a campaign against drug abuse. And she's one of these people who's become internationally recognised. She was the first Indian and first woman to be appointed head of the United Nations Police and Police Advisor in the United Nations Department of Peace Operations as well. And she's a social activist and writer. So quite an admirable woman. Mm. And so maybe go, who was one of these sort of the trailblazing female detectives in history? And I came up with Alice Clement. Alice Clement, born Alice Bush in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in 1878. She began working for the Chicago Police Department in 1909. And initially, she was patrolling shops looking for pickpockets. And in 1913, she became a detective, the first female detective on the force. There was a lot of crime among women this period in Chicago. And there was a lot of homeless and vagrant women. There was prostitution issues. And the Chicago Police Department felt they needed female detectives to deal with female problems. One person who was not on board with this was the hilariously named Chief McWeeny. Chief McWeeny said, when he was told there were going to be women detectives being hired, he said, "There will be no peekaboo waists, sheath, or tight skirts, or any other frills. They will be assigned to the bathing beaches, parks, and amusement parks and other places where women, girls, and children congregate. Gossip will not be tolerated." The women's only equipment to be carried in a handbag was their badge, a whistle, and keys to telephone patrol boxes from which they could call the nearest station to call the men in case any real trouble arose. Now, Alice Clement did not need the men to do her job for her. She became famous across America. There were articles about her in the Chicago Tribune, in Variety, in the New York Evening Telegram. She, you know, some of these articles rather patronizingly referred to her as the city's own feminine Sherlock Holmes. But they also called her the savior of souls, the nemesis to many a masher, the wonder of the police world, terror of the guilty, and hope to the friendless. She went undercover to expose fake clairvoyance, or clairvoyance, as they're known. She said that her most useful disguise piece was a hat. She said, "Hats are the most important. Large and small, light and dark, and a vivid hue, floppy-brimmed and tailored. There's nothing that alters a woman's appearance more than a change in headgear." Never wearing the same outfit twice, apparently she watched fakes and charlatans peering into crystal balls and trying to defraud people of their money, apparently some 500 times as she was working to uncover these people who were conning ordinary decent citizens out of their money. She learned jujitsu, apparently, and took down one criminal who groaned to a reporter, "Gee, that dame packs an awful kick in her left." She could dress up as a bag woman. She seduced embezzlers. She said, older men who were trying to embezzle money from companies, "Old dips fall for us." So she used her womanly wiles to her advantage. And in 1919, with the blessing of the police chief, it has to be said, who I think was a new person, not McWeenie at this stage, she wrote, produced, and starred in a movie about herself.
Oh, yes, please.
Yeah, called Dregs of the City, in which she saves a country girl from the bright lights, flashy dress, and glib tongue of the city's underworld.
That is definitely the working title for Sex and the City 3, isn't it?
It really is, isn't it? Her most famous case, apparently, was called The Dulcimer. It was about the murder of a Chicago girl. And this is Little Miss Perry. She was known as a young, destitute woman living in an old building in Lower Clark Street. And she was stricken with typhoid, but seemed to have died by chance. Clement's male investigative partner accepted that there was no foul play had taken place, but Clement had other suspicions and began looking deeply into the story. It turned out that Perry's long-lost aunt, Mrs. Brent, had learned that this girl had inherited a valuable piece of property, including a dulcimer. And over the course of various visits, the aunt was trying to figure out a way of doing away with Perry and taking on the inheritance for herself. And Clement figured out that the aunt had poisoned the dulcimer. Mrs. Brent had spotted that her niece would occasionally lick her fingers between plucking the strings on the dulcimer. And so she figured out that if she poisoned the strings, it would eventually cause Miss Perry to fall ill. And she, Mrs. Brent, would eventually be there to capitalise on the girl's death.
I mean, that just sounds like something from an Agatha Christie novel.
It really does. And to add to that, Clement confronted Brent with the truth, and according to this article, Brent's face grew ghastly. She seemed to seek for some means of escape. "You have confessed by your actions that you are guilty," Clement said. "Now, before we take you to police headquarters, tell us why you committed this murder." And Mrs. Brent confessed she'd killed the girl in hopes of recovering a lost family fortune. But before Clement could take the woman to the station, a wild scream interrupted. Clement said, "We whirled towards the bed just in time to see the woman who had murdered her niece plunge forward, blood streaming from her throat where she had pierced it with a penknife." No further explanation ever came from her, for 10 minutes later, a physician looked upwards with a queer little expression and uttered one little word which has caused so many sorrows in this world and ended so much suffering. Dead. As in so many Agatha Christie novels, the person, when they're confronted, like, throws themselves in front of a car or jumps off a roof or something. And so it was with the case of the dulcimer.
Wow. I mean, the case of the tainted dulcimer is a short story I would absolutely read.
Yeah. So I like Alice Clement, a woman in what was very much a man's world at the time, who didn't need the men to get to the bottom of cases like the dulcimer.
Big fan. I think that the best detective of all time is Basil. The mouse detective. The great mouse detective, if you will.
Yes!
Which is one of the first two or three Disney movies I ever watched at the cinema. It came out in 1986, and I'll be honest, having read about it, I've not watched it since I was at most six, and I will be going on Disney Plus this week and rewatching it thoroughly, not least as your friend and mine, Roger Ebert, gives it a rollickingly good review. It is based on the children's book Basil of Baker Street by the writers Eve Titus and Paul Galdone, and obviously draws heavily on Sherlock Holmes, not least because the main character is named after Basil Rathbone, who is one of the best remembered players of Holmes. In fact, his voice appears in the movie 19 years after his death. Very modern technique, they sampled it from a reading called the Red-Headed League, which is... Sherlock,
that's so good.
Sherlock Holmes also mentions Basil as one of his aliases in the story The Adventures of Black Peter. So it's got real real heft in it. I just found some good facts about it. I'm not going to tell you about the ins and the outs of the movie. Go watch it yourself, preferably with your kids. It was released in 86. In 1985, the film Young Sherlock Holmes, which I absolutely adore, was released, but it absolutely flopped in the box office. And so Michael Eisner, who had just become CEO at Disney at the time, decided that the film should be renamed from Basil of Baker Street, the name of the book, to The Great Mouse Detective, because he felt the name Basil was too English and so it wouldn't sell so well. The retitling of the movie was unpopular with filmmakers in the company to the extent that the animator Ed Gombert wrote a satirical inter-office memo which gave preceding Disney films generic titles such as Seven Little Men Help a Girl, The Wonderful Elephant Who Could Really Fly, The Little Deer Who Grew Up, The Girl with the See-Through Shoes, Two Dogs Fall in Love, and my favourite, A Boy, a Bear, and a Big Black Cat. And these generic titles would later appear as categories on Jeopardy, which I like very much indeed. The best character in it, as so often happens in these, is the baddie, Rattigan.
Rattigan is such a good name for a baddie as well.
It really is. This big, beefy, cigar-chomping rat. He was actually initially designed to be thin and weaselly. But during a story meeting, Glenn Keane, who was one of the writers, decided to base the stature of him on a then Disney CEO called Ron Miller, who is a 6'6" former NFL player for the Los Angeles Rams. He also was thumbing through photographs of people from London in the 1800s and saw one of a railroad builder chomping on a big fat cigar whilst wearing a top hat. And he basically was like, this guy, this is who Rattigan is. He is a rat sucking a cigar, dressed to the hilt. He's a sewer rat, dressed like a king, and he lives like a king. And that's what they went for.
Yeah, because when he's not in his like fine cloaks, he has this really like vicious feral sort of appearance at some point in the film, which is great.
And brilliantly, Basil was initially modelled on Bing Crosby. But they then changed to a chap. I recognise the photo, but I don't really know him, but a famous actor called Leslie Howard.
Oh, yes. We mentioned Leslie Howard.
Oh, have we?
Yeah, Leslie Howard died in a plane crash. His plane was shot down during World War II. He was an actor. And his death was announced in the Times on the same day of the fake death of Major William Martin, the man who never was, the fake identity that was created for Operation Mincemeat, which listeners to our next podcast release about the world's worst pilot might hear a little bit more about.
Yeah.
Leslie Howard was a huge star in a lot of, you know, great films of the 30s, and then he starred in a lot of, I think, propaganda films for the Allies during the 40s as well.
Nice. And obviously, I imagine you know the other extraordinarily famous voice in it, who voiced Rattigan.
Oh God, I can't remember who voiced Rattigan.
It's Vincent Price.
It's Vincent, of course, it's Vincent bloody Price.
Now,
yes.
This was 52 years into his extraordinarily esteemed career, and he came in to do an audition, and apparently he commented, "If anybody but Disney had asked me, I would have been offended. But Disney is a really magical name to me." And the way he speaks about it is beautiful. He described it as, "The Great Mouse Detective was the fulfillment of a dream, and it proved to be an exhilarating experience. I loved doing the part because they let me in on the secrets of animation. At my age, and when you've been around this long, what you're looking for is challenges. Rattigan was a great challenge because I was part of the creative process. The filmmakers showed me hundreds of character drawings, gave me the freedom to expand on that. It was a reciprocal experience. They enjoyed my interpretation, and I thought theirs was brilliant." He summed it up by stating, "Rattigan is the ultimate villain." Oh, yeah. I love him. He's such a gentleman.
Yes.
Two last little facts that I love about it. The Great Mouse Detective was the directorial debut of John Musker and Ron Clements, who are legends in the company now. They co-directed The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and Moana. But this is where it all started.
Yeah.
And last of all, bearing in mind this is 1986, everyone goes on and on about Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin showcasing computer animation for the first time, but this was one of the very earliest uses of it. So the infamous climax of the film is Basil duels Ratigan on Big Ben. And originally it was all going to be on the outside of Big Ben. I'm sure deliberately referencing Harold Lloyd movies of him dangling off the arms on the clock face. But in The Mouse Detective, they end up inside Big Ben, going around all of the moving gears and winches and ratchets. And all of that is computer animated.
Is it?
So making this not just a brilliant movie and an exciting movie and a charming movie and a movie with Vincent Price, but a pioneering movie on a technological level.
Wow, and that's great.
So for all those reasons, I'm going to say that Basil the Mouse Detective is the greatest detective of all time.
But we're going to go with Alice Clement, right?
Yeah, she's absolutely cracking.
She's banging, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, Alison Clement and Basil the Mouse Detective is the buddy cop movie that needs to be made.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. She needs to rewrite Dregs of the City. All right. Well, that concludes our Best of the Worst of the Best episode. Normal service will be resumed next week. We're recording a couple of regular episodes with guests this week. So you have the world's worst pilot and the world's worst wizard to look forward to in the next few weeks.
Yes, you do. With also, hopefully, the worst zoo and then the world's worst aircraft for the world's worst pilot to fly. And yes, we have some other Patreon-nominated topics that we're hoping to nail in the next few months as well. So much exciting podcasting on the horizon for you to get your ears around. But for now, thank you so much for listening. And hey, at least one of you I know is going to go off and watch Basil the Mouse Detective now. So do us all a favour. Do a hashtag Twitter watch-along and we'll all enjoy that, eh? Tag us in.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. See you next week.